This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On previous shows that we've done about food, we have learned that our food choices have been greatly limited when compared to those of our ancestors. Let's face it, when was the last time you sat down to a steaming plate of squirrel or wild boar or even pheasant? Today, our diet consists primarily of chicken, beef, pork, some fish, and on rare occasions, foods that are considered exotic today but would have been common to our ancestors. This is not only happening with foods derived from animals, it is happening in the plant world as well. This trend limits our diets and has led food producers to cater to our shrinking tastes. Today, 95% of the world's calories come from only 30 species, and worse, 3/4 of the world's food comes from only 12 plants and 5 animal species. Now, this may satisfy our increasingly limited taste, but it also threatens the future of the very foods that we love. It doesn't have to be this way, and award-winning journalist Simran Sethi traveled the world to meet scientists, farmers, chefs, winemakers, beer brewers, coffee roasters, chocolate connoisseurs, bakers, and others, to both understand how and why we have adopted this mono diet, but also to find ways to preserve endangered flavors and ensure that food has a future. Simran Sethi is author of Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love, and she joins us in our Spirit Square studio this morning. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you here. And also with us, she's actually here, thanks to Johnson & Wales chef on assignment, author and baker Peter Reinhardt. Among his many books is his most recent, Bread Revolution, World-Class Baking with Sprouted and Whole Grains, Heirloom Flours, and Fresh Techniques. Good to see you.
Great to see you again, Mike.
Let me turn your microphone on since you're going to be with us for a while.
Well, thank you, and I'm glad to be here.
Nice to have you here, too. So your book and your research is about many things and many foods, but you titled it Bread, Wine, Chocolate. Now, obviously, those are threatened, too, by the very things I just spoke about. But
yes.
Why did you title it Bread, Wine, Chocolate? Is that to get our attention, or or they're more threatened than other foods?
I could have titled it, certainly, Wheat, Rice, Corn.
Yeah.
I probably would have brought in a different audience, and that actually was a turning point. When I was doing the research for the book, I was going to look at nutritional staples and also look at sort of what has become the mono diet of the world largely, what Colin Corey and researchers who analyzed 50 years of data on what 98% of the population eats have coined the global standard diet. And that does consist of wheat, rice, corn, soybean, and palm oil. But it didn't have the catchiness of bread, wine, and chocolate. And those were originally going to just be the things I threw on, you know, top for flavor. I was going to talk about bread and wheat for sure as a nutritional staple and a real spiritual staple. But I wanted to have these other things to entice people. When I came back to the United States after doing all this research in Italy, I decided to go on a cleanse and kind of just clean out my system for a while. No wine, no coffee, no chocolate. And I realized those were the things I really missed. And those were the things I had an emotional connection to and wanted to talk about.
You go through the grocery store, and we'll talk about that in some depth later on, but you go through the grocery store, and you just said that foods that we eat are primarily made up of corn, wheat, rice, palm oil, which actually surprised me.
Yeah.
Don't know why. I guess it's in a lot of stuff.
Now it is.
And soybeans. When did this start happening? And why?
So palm oil is a great emulsifier, and it can be used. It's a fat that's shelf-stable, and it can be used a lot. So we now see this has infiltrated so many of the processed foods that we see in grocery stores. That is a fairly recent change. The evolution has happened in the last 20 years toward increased processed foods, toward a standardization throughout agriculture. This is the result of a number of different factors, including globalization. But it's really one, you know, you'd mentioned earlier consumers and kind of our changing tastes. These things have happened in tandem. So it's what is provided, what is available, what becomes cheapest, what is most convenient, alongside of what it is that we desire. And these things, over the last 25 years in particular, have really started to evolve towards this narrowing of foods.
Well, it's easy to point to big agriculture and say, well, they did it because it's easier to grow these crops.
Yeah.
And they can do it en masse, and they've got it down to a science.
Sure.
And blah, blah, blah.
Sure.
And yet. We are probably to blame, aren't we? Because when you look around the country and you look at the proliferation, and not just the country, the world, of McDonald's, Burger King, Pizza Hut, you name it.
Yeah.
The things that make those restaurants popular
Right.
Is that no matter where you go in the world, if you order McDonald's hamburger and fries, it's going to be exactly the same. You know what you're going to get, and that's why we go there, because we can trust that
safety.
We're going to get what we like.
Right, consistency and safety. And that's what we've moved toward. You go to Starbucks anywhere in the world, you know what your latte is going to taste like. The serendipity of flavors that is available is such an astonishing and wonderful thing. But I think that points to a really important part of this puzzle, which is we have moved toward standardization and consistency in a lot of things. We want to wake up every morning knowing our coffee is going to be exactly what it was the day before. But what I try to introduce in the book is the continuum of flavors that are available to us, that are the result of diversity, that are the result of a diverse number of places. When you investigate a wine and taste all the different terroirs and discover these different places that you hadn't been aware of before, those exact kinds of flavors, this diversity of flavors are available in chocolate. They're available in coffee. We see this incredible roasters doing amazing things with different origins. And I think that's something that we are really missing out on. When we demand sameness all the time, think about agriculture. These are products that are seasonal. These are products that are it come from the earth. So there's always going to be variability. But our system is one that is devised to take that variability out and to build in consistency. But what we've also seen is that our tastes have kind of recalibrated along with the tweaks that are done in the system to ensure these kinds of flavor profiles.
But who's driving it? Is it agriculture driving it, or
you mentioned McDonald's. You know, you talked about big food, big ag. I would say the important thing to consider, though, is our role as consumers. We can point the finger at us, too, but it also points to the solution lies with us. So every single element that you're talking about, whether it's the restaurants, whether it's the people who are growing the foods or raising the livestock, or the people who are eating them, we all play a role in this conservation. But we, the eaters, I think are the one component or the one audience that had really been left out of the conversation.
Yeah, and I know that the books, first it seems to be about food, but really in the end it's a lot of about empowerment, isn't it? Because it seems like what you just described is how do we get the power back to protect flavors, protect foods that maybe have disappeared. Well, what can we do?
It's right, and define and own our deliciousness. There's a giant smile on my face, Peter, because you got it. You got exactly what the point of the book was, and that is to say, like, this lies in our hands. So I want to back up and just talk about this loss that I'm talking about. The loss of agricultural biodiversity is something that starts in the soil. The loss of diversity in the soil, the loss of diversity in pollinators that pollinate one-third of the crops that we eat, the loss of diversity in plants, in animals, in aquatic life. So freshwater and saltwater, fish and other marine life. And the reason this is a challenge, the reason that we need to worry about the fact that you'd said, you mentioned at the top of the show that we now 95% of our calories come from 30 species, is because this creates a very perilous way to create a food system. I describe in the book that our food, the pyramid now has a point as fine as the Seattle Space Needle. And you would never do this. No investment, no advisor would say to you, hey, Mike, how about this? Put 100% of your savings in one stock or in five stocks and cross your fingers and hope they do well. That's not how we would invest our money, and that's not how we should be creating food. Because by doing that, we increase risk. We've seen this before with the Irish potato famine. Mm-hmm. We've seen this with problems with wheat leaf rust. We're seeing this with coffee leaf rust. We've seen this with bananas. It goes on and on and on.
So at the same time, we have this desire for sameness or predictability, I guess.
Right.
If you go to a restaurant, you want to know that your money's going to get you exactly what you anticipated. That's why you go to McDonald's or whatever. But at the same time that's happening, we have this emergence of the food culture. We have all these cooking and food shows on television now. We have coffee shops that have cropped up that specialize in special kinds of coffee, not just Maxwell House or Folgers. We have microbreweries all over this city. We have wine shops. We've developed a palate for wine in this country that we never used to have. Yeah. And because of Johnson & Wales, at least here in Charlotte, we have all these restaurants opening up where they do serve things that aren't chicken, fish, and pork. And people go there, and they expect to pay a lot of money for it, and they enjoy what they have. They're looking for this difference. How do you explain that dichotomy? They got two things going on at once.
Well, I think that's the human condition. That's the human condition. You know, I crave familiarity and sameness in certain things, but I also have learned to really expand my palate for diversity. And that's something that we haven't, I think, paid enough attention to, that we really have an opportunity to taste the world through our plates. When you mentioned chicken and pork and beef, we're talking about in the United States. When I mentioned in the book, I take a tour through the grocery store, that what we don't see when we look at floor-to-ceiling aisles stocked full of foods is that they'll come from one source. For example, every ice cream, every yogurt, every milk comes from exactly one cow, or I should say 90% of it comes from the Holstein Friesian cow. So what happens if that cow gets a disease? What happens to our entire dairy system? That's the sort of food system that we're building. We have exactly one banana. We have the capacity in the world to grow 1,000 bananas. And right now, the one banana that we grow, the Cavendish that replaced the Gros Michel, is now threatened by a disease that we don't have a cure for.
So let's talk about that for a second, because the Gros Michel is in your book. And the Gros Michel is the banana that we used to eat.
Yep.
We used to be able to buy. We can't buy it anymore because a disease got to it.
Succumbed to tropical race 4.
So the Cavendish replaced it. And the Cavendish replaced it in part because it travels well.
Yes.
It doesn't bruise badly and it doesn't rot before it gets to the grocery store shelf. But it is now threatened by something very similar to what the previous banana
is. It is a different strain of the exact same disease that felled the banana.
And we've done a show that touched on this before, so this is what I'm remembering from that show, that the Cavendish banana that we gravitate toward, because it's the only banana in the grocery store, is not even the best-tasting banana.
Far from. It's starchier, it's less sweet than the Gros Michel, and it doesn't have a name. When you go to the grocery store, it just says banana.
Chiquita,
right?
Is what it says.
That's, you know, Dole, maybe. They are picked. I visited banana plantations when I was in Ecuador doing research on cacao, which becomes chocolate. They're picked before they're ripened, and they're these, you know, kind of green masses, and you think to yourself, they're going to ripen once they get to their destination. They'll be artificially ripened. But that we have created wheat, we have created bananas, we have created, you know, we have cultivated, excuse me, not created, different crops or kind of like elevated the varieties that stand strong on store shelves, not for their nutritional value, not for their taste, but for the fact that they can sit on a shelf for a long time and look beautiful. And I think that's a real problem for us because we have moved away from defining the foods we love through taste and through nutritional value.
Hence cardboard tomatoes.
Well, as Simran was talking about the perilousness of this dependency on a few species, I just saw The Big Short, a movie that I think everyone should see because, and as you were describing it, it's the exact same situation. You pull one peg out of, you know, the problem that caused the collapse in the economies, the whole house comes crumbling down. In your book, you talk about certain things. For instance, if we lose fruit flies, if we lose yeast, if certain kinds of things that are the building blocks, the whole structure comes down. If we lose that banana, we've got no other banana. It's not like there's 12 other bananas that can take its place.
Not right now, there's not. And that's what I think we see more and more, that diversity that you just referenced, the yeast, the diversity. We need diversity in our soil to create good crops. We need diversity in our pollinators. We've all heard now about colony collapse disorder and what's happening with the bees. We need to understand that the things that we are doing, the industrialized agriculture, the way we grow food now, is actually threatening the existence of agriculture. And what the Food and Agriculture of the United Nations has determined through research is that agroecology, growing crops together in polycultures, looking at smaller farmers, smallholder farmers, small family farmers, are actually the people who feed the world. Mm. We have here in the United States seen that it's large-scale agribusinesses, but globally that is not who is taking care of us.
And when we come back, that's what I want to talk about, because this is not just the fact that we're missing out on all kinds of flavors and variety of foods. It's actually threatening the existence of food. Simran Sethi is our guest, author of Red, Wine, Chocolate. Peter Reinhart also with us, our Johnson & Wales chef on assignment. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
We'll get back to our encore conversation on vanishing foods in just a moment here on 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bradley, formerly Bradley Arendt Bolt Cummings, a full-service law firm. The name has changed, but dedication to serving clients and communities in the banking and financial services industry in Charlotte and the nation remains. Bradley.com. and from Carolina Pest Management, protecting homes and families and businesses since 1939, offering botanical-based mosquito and pest services plus termite and moisture control options. CarolinaPest.com. There's a troubling controversy swirling around the quality of drinking water from wells near coal ash ponds. First, the state said it wasn't safe to drink. Now they say it is. The governor has accused a state scientist of lying, and now his boss has resigned, saying she can't work for the state government. So how safe is our water, and can we believe what we're told? A conversation about that when Charlotte talks Tuesday morning at 9 here on 90.7 WFAE.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Hillary Clinton detailed her economic plan as another batch of emails was released from her time as Secretary of State. Analysis of her vision for jobs and trade, and new questions about the relationship between the State Department and the Clinton Foundation.
Join the Diane Rehm Show following Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon on 90.7 WFAE, listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're with Simran Sethi, the author of Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love. It's a kind of a scary book, but also it's promising because there is a solution to this, and you're part of it. Peter Reinhardt is also here. He's the Johnson & Wales chef on assignment who joins us repeatedly during the year. Thank you for being with us again, Peter. The variety of foods we have has diminished greatly over the years, and that's by design, by big ag, and also because our tastes have been demanding sameness or predictability. But the most delicious, I'm told, of the flavors and the variety of foods that we have at our disposal are actually being irrevocably lost, you say. So how would you compare this to the problem of climate change? People are climate change deniers, and those who believe in climate change say we're at the tipping point. If we don't do something quickly, we can't reverse it. Where are we on that scale with these foods?
Well, one doesn't know, because one of the challenges of climate change is we can do climate modeling, but we don't exactly know what will happen, mm-hmm. right? We do know that we could experience increased flooding. We could experience increased droughts. Like, these are the kinds of polarities that we're seeing. But the reason that we lose diversity is multiple. Pests, diseases, industrialization that has increased standardization, global trade agreements, politics even have impacted the kinds of foods that are grown. I talk about in the book as a result of the Iran hostage crisis, the U.S. placed an embargo on Iran. And it actually impacted greatly the pistachio industry and allowed the United States to take a place that didn't exist before for pistachios. And now we're one of the top global producers
of pistachios. They were the world producer of pistachios.
They were. They were indeed.
When we put the embargo on them, we became the world leader.
Indeed, we took their place, yes. And, you know, and another thing that I think is really fascinating is that every food comes from a place. At least I'll speak for myself. I really didn't consider where coffee came from. You know, I had some fuzzy notion of farmers and fields, and I thought maybe Colombia, you know, because we'd all heard of Juan Valdez. But the birthplace, the deep birthplace of all foods are very different. Apples, the center of origin, the deep birthplace for apples is China, the center of origin for coffee. We wake up every morning for the grace of Ethiopia, by the grace of Ethiopian farmers that's the place where it was born, and that's the place where diversity is sustained. So because of all these factors, such as climate change, pests, diseases, et cetera, that have resulted in the loss of biodiversity, the way we save it is through what we call ex situ collections, out of place collections, where we'll save seeds, for example, or we'll save, I talk about some things aren't grown from seeds. So we have apple orchards that are ex situ collections. We save honeybee sperm, we save cattle embryo, all kinds of things to sustain the diversity. But we also save it by growing it in situ, in place. Heirloom tomatoes are a perfect example of that. And we save them in the wild, in wild places, in the forests. But we need to keep those forests going. We need to keep that diversity intact. That's also where the wild relatives of these crops grow that we can kind of tap into for some of the traits that we might need to breed in the future.
Because you talk in the book about everything, it all starts at the microscopic level.
Yeah.
That everything starts with microorganisms and then travels up through the soil, through the seeds, through the pollinators.
Exactly.
Which is what you just talked about.
Yeah.
That. So how do they all fit into what we demand and what we actually get out of the food system?
Mm-hmm.
And if we're just demanding sameness, you're saying that we're killing off the pollinators were killing off the microorganisms?
No. Neonicotinoid pesticides and neonicotinoids are probably the ones that are insecticides, I think it is, actually, that are killing off the pollinators. Those kinds of things are still being determined. But what I am trying to emphasize in the book is that we, the eaters, have a role too. Conservationists haven't included us part of that equation. Ex situ conservation, in situ conservation, in the wild and on farm. What I introduce in the book, and I'm not the first to do it, Slow Food has done a tremendous effort. Gary Nabin has written wonderful books about saving foods by savoring them, by eating them. But I really wanted to place the eater, us, the eating public, front and center through foods that we were already familiar with. It's really hard to think about saving an obscure squash that you've never heard of. But if I tell you, our coffee, our morning coffee is threatened because we're losing the diversity in the forests in Ethiopia, which is where coffee was born, which is where the coffee exists, and this is what we'll need to tap into in the future to ensure the sustenance of coffee. Right now, Guatemala and other Latin American countries have declared states of emergency because coffee leaf rust is wiping out the entire crop. They were grown in monoculture, an entire, you know, entire fields of sameness. And what happens when one disease hits all those crops? They all go away. They all disappear. We have replaced with cacao. Cacao is a crop that becomes chocolate. We've replaced some of the diverse heirloom varieties of cacao with a hybrid that has increased disease resistance, but has none of the flavor profiles. Experts have defined the kind of flavor qualities of the hybrid CCN51, the primary cacao that's starting to take over and replace a lot of these diverse cacaos, as having flavor notes that are akin to rusty nails. I don't want a chocolate that's flavor notes are akin to rusty nails. I want to taste the good stuff, and I don't want the good stuff to disappear.
Because what happens when you have lesser quality chocolate is that the chocolate companies just put more sugar and other things in it to cover up those tastes, which just sort of feeds the addiction that we're trying to get away from, which is more sugar, more additives to make things sort of palatable.
And to make them taste the same over and over again. We don't demand diversity in a Hershey's bar, but we can find incredible taste that we didn't even know existed if we look towards specialty chocolate. If you're only going and, you know, having, I don't know, Folgers or Maxwell in your cup every morning, you're losing out on the amazing diversity of places.
You mentioned that at
coffee.
One point in your life that Twix was among your favorite brands
Absolutely.
Of chocolate.
I started off my first beer was a Bud Light. I love Bartles and James wine coolers. I am no different than anybody else. But I started on this culinary adventure to discover things that I didn't even know existed.
Yeah.
And I was so delighted by them. I wanted to share them with everyone.
You also discovered this problem, which you didn't know existed. You call this the most important issue in food and farming that you'd never heard
exactly.
of. That means most of us have never heard of it either.
No.
But there must be others who have been and have been aware of this for quite a while. Are there?
Absolutely.
And how did you stumble upon it?
Well, think about go back to the banana and the Gros Michel. So conservationists were one step ahead in introducing the Cavendish banana, the less delicious banana to the world, right, as the one that we get in our grocery stores. Conservationists have been fighting this fight for a long time. Some of them, we are just one step ahead in some instances. Or what we're seeing right now with the Cavendish banana, we haven't caught up yet. We don't have a banana to replace the Cavendish yet. We're trying to,
There are a thousand other bananas. So why can't we?
We haven't explored them as being the export ready bananas.
Meaning
the ones that
they
can ship
travel?
Well, that won't travel well, that we have a supply chain for.
But we can fly bananas in less than a day from wherever they're grown to wherever they need to be. So why don't they travel well?
Well, we don't typically fly in bananas. We ship in bananas from Central America, and they come by boat. They are put on the boat when they're still green. By the time they get here, they've started to ripen. We artificially ripen whatever else needs to be ripened, and that's how it ends up on our shelves. We ship in foods from all over the world now because trade agreements have made it cheaper to say, process pork that was raised in North Carolina, process it in China, and ship it back to us in the package. We can cultivate hundreds, thousands of varieties of historic fruits and vegetables here. Here in the United States, we've lost almost every one of them. And we now source our apples from New Zealand, our lamb from Australia, and ship these things in because apparently the costs, you know, to ship them in are cheaper now than it is to really support local industries here in the United States.
And apples are a good example of the flavor that we're missing, because mm-hmm. apples in the grocery, the red delicious apple is red, but it's
red.
Not delicious.
It feels like a joke, doesn't it? It feels like a cruel, cruel joke to call it delicious. Yes.
And that's what's in the grocery
that's
store.
One-fifth of what we'll find.
Although I will say, yeah. I was in a Harris Teeter mm-hmm. Not too long ago, around Christmas time, and they had samples of an apple, I think it was called.
Fuji's.
Oh, my.
Yeah. Oh, my. That's what I'm saying, Mike. You just got it. Think about if your life was full of just red delicious bananas, and then you had a Fuji. There it is. Oh, my. We can grow 1,000 kinds of apples in the United States. We see 5 on store shelves.
And we don't do it because they don't travel well? They don't sit in the store well? Why?
We don't – because – red delicious
ugly.
Apples.
They're not
because,
as pretty.
Exactly. Because they are. They don't blemish quickly.
Yeah, if they bruise because they have a thin skin, uh-huh. the delicious apple travels really well. We see this across the board in all of the various foods. And I think we're also at an opportunity moment mm-hmm. because of awareness, because of books like Simran's and Dan Barber and Michael Pollan, who we've had on the show, writing about these things. And there is kind of a consciousness movement
Absolutely.
Going on, an awareness
Absolutely.
That's opening people in a new way. Because just like Simran said, she started out, you know, with the basic, same basic foods as everybody else, a Twix bar, but was able to actually evolve as an eater. And I think we're seeing this evolution in a small scale still, but it always has to start as a small scale. But we've been tracking this for years right on this show, and we've seen it kind of start to snowball. There could be an opportunity here to, you know, for a much larger movement to try to protect these disappearing species.
Well, the loss of flavor should be enough to get most of us off our tuckuses to change our habits. But it's not just the loss of flavor. It is the fact that it's threatening the food supply, at which you've talked about here. But it's so troubled you, this discovery, that you quit your job. A job that you said you couldn't get fired
tenured associate professorship. I could not get fired.
Sold your house, gave away your car, and embarked on this journey to learn how we could save the tastes we love. Was this because you reacted to something that you really felt was planet-threatening, or because it simply bothered you so much you wanted to find out more?
I was so astonished that it was this thing that I didn't know about. And I was so astonished that I had been talking about environmental issues for well over a decade as an environmental journalist, and increasingly was talking about these stories through the lens of food, because food is so intimate, because food is tied to memory and history and culture, and the homogenization of everything, the erasing of place in everything. We now think the foods come from the grocery store. We now think, you know, the coffee comes from a big company. You know, we don't think about the places where these things were grown, the hands that cultivated them. I wanted to reconnect to those things, and I realized through that reconnection, I was able to actually affect change.
Is the slow food movement a part of that reconnection process?
The slow food movement is absolutely a part. I want to go back to something Peter said about the Twix bar, and I want to emphasize to people that this is not some sort of fancy, precious movement. I will still cut you for a Twix. Let me be clear. Okay? I still love me a Twix bar. But now I have seen there's a whole world that was not available to me before, that was undiscovered, and it is a world in which I delight. When I tell you that Colin Corey and researchers have discovered that the global standard diet consists of wheat, rice, corn, soybean, and palm oil, what I am also offering is that anything outside of that is a shift in the right direction. It's what Colin Corey said to me was a revolutionary act. He's like, eating olive oil now is a revolutionary act, and I quote him verbatim in that. So there is so much opportunity to participate in this change.
Yeah, I read that in your book, Eating Olive Oil is a Revolutionary Act, and that kind of struck me as mm-hmm. interesting, because are you saying that years ago olive oil was a staple in the cupboard? It was always there, and now it's been replaced by canola oil and palm
exactly.
oil and all these other
exactly.
fake Wesson oils and things like that.
Soya
is that what you're
oils,
saying?
Blends. What I'm suggesting is – well, I'm not suggesting it. Let me be clear. Research scientists are suggesting it. People who have spent decades studying this information are suggesting that our our diet, the staples have been reduced so dramatically that to suggest now that eating olive oil is a revolutionary act, this came out of a scientist's mouth, not mine, and I was absolutely stunned. Hmm. I will say, when I first started doing this research, I thought I was going to be talking about some pretty esoteric things. You know, I thought I was going to – and then when he said that to me, everything pivoted, because what he is suggesting, what conservationists are suggesting, is even expanding our palates a little bit, even taking just a quick pivot in the grocery store and looking at the diversity and the range of things that are available to us, flipping over a package and seeing where it comes from is actually something that can shift this tide.
You went, when you found out about this, you went to Italy.
I did.
And immersed yourself in this. Now, I'm just curious as to about why Italy, and I think I know why, because it was in Italy in the early 80s when I first discovered that food could taste good. I mean, you could pick up something on your fork and put it in your mouth and literally feel an explosion of flavor. I'd never experienced it before, and I thought, my God, what is this? Is that why you went there? Because they know how to do food?
I'm Indian, so I would argue there are many countries that know how to do food.
Right.
And I grew up, you know, as I mentioned in the book, I grew up in North Carolina, but I'm of Indian origin, and I grew up with the kind of the peak of masala and, you know, the cloying sweetness of a pecan pie on my tongue, and along with barbecue and grits and all the other good stuff that we know. The reason I went to Italy is because the Food and Agriculture of the United Nations is based there, one of the most, arguably the most important research, you know, institution dedicated to food. In addition to that, Biodiversity International is housed there, which is the largest and, I would say, personally most important research institution looking at agricultural biodiversity. So I moved there to better understand what it was that we had lost, so I could, again, explain to readers how we could best save it.
But what you experienced, Mike, in Italy, I think is important, because I would call that a culinary epiphany.
Mm-hmm.
You had an aha moment. And without the aha moment, it's very difficult to get people to buy into any of these other issues that we're talking about, because you don't know what it is you're missing. So either you can either be scared to death and motivated by fear, or you can be motivated by flavor. And if you get, you know, the flavor is a much more positive motivation.
Well, that's going to be another question. This has been a steady creep. It hasn't just happened overnight. So because it has snuck up on us, do most people notice that they can't get what their grandparents had, that they don't get the flavor that their grandparents had, that they don't get the variety in the grocery store? Because I remember when I was a little kid, going to the grocery store with my grandmother. It wasn't a big supermarket.
No.
It was a tiny little place where you could get tomatoes in the summer.
Exactly.
That's it. No tomatoes
season.
In the fall. Mm-hmm. And it was small, and it had a butcher in the back where you actually had to ask for him to cut the chickens. You know, it wasn't like going to the Harris Teeter.
Where it was already packaged up for you,
right.
Looking pretty. No, you know, the thing is, when I first started talking about this, when I first learned about it, I will say, I was a little bit perplexed, because I thought to myself, we have more diversity than we've ever had before. I mean, have you been to a grocery store?
Yeah.
And people look at me like I'm crazy. You know, what are you talking about? We're losing diversity. What we see in the grocery store is a lot of the same types of foods and a lot of the same variety. Like I mentioned earlier, 90% of our dairy from one cow. As an example, the diversity we see are in maybe flavors and maybe brands, if that.
Yeah, you went through the Walmart grocery store in Winston-Salem and counted 153 flavors of ice cream and 8 different brands of yogurt.
Mm-hmm.
But every one of them came from that. You said the
90%.
Holstein Friesian cow. You counted 21 kinds of potato chips. But in the produce aisle, found only 5 types of potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
How many types of potatoes are there, and can you taste the difference?
Yes. If you're from Peru, they actually have a potato park. They're the center of diversity for potatoes. This exquisite diversity exists in everything, in corn, in rice. It's just about discovery. We're now discovering it in coffee. We're sort of starting to discover it in chocolate. But what I am proposing is we actually have the opportunity to discover it in everything. And with globalization, a lot of those foods can actually be available to us if we look for them.
Cimarron Sainte is our guest. Her book is called Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love. Peter Reinhart is also with us, our Johnson & Wales chef on assignment. There's more to talk about. And you can get in on the conversation, too, at charlottetalks at wfae.org or searching WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
We'll get back to our encore conversation on vanishing foods in just a moment here on 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Novant Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine, providing comprehensive services and customized treatment plans. More at novanthealth.org/orthopedics. And from Heartwood Tree Service, 85% of tree canopy growth occurs in the spring. Heartwood exists to provide education, tree health care, and pruning to grow human appreciation. Assistance available at heartwoodtree.com. Hillary Clinton details her economic plan as another batch of emails is released from the Democratic presidential nominee's time as Secretary of State. Coming up in 20 minutes on the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock, they'll have analysis of Clinton's vision for jobs and trade, as well as new questions about the relationship between the State Department and the Clinton Foundation. Again, that's coming up at 10 here on 90.7 WFAE, listener-funded public radio.
Raising kids isn't easy any way you do it. It means hard choices sometimes.
Well, I couldn't go to school and work and go to their work program. There was just no way out of it, so one had to go. And I had to obviously leave school to continue working to support my three children.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, Life After Welfare Reform, next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30, following All Things Considered, on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about food and the lack of variety in the foods that we eat, which is causing us to miss out on all kinds of new flavors and nuances in the foods that we eat. We're bored. That's what the problem is. But the problem is worse than that, because it's becoming a threat to the very existence of how we create food in the first place. Cimarron Sethe has written about this extensively in a very readable book called Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love. She's with us, and Peter Reinhardt is here from Johnson & Wales. Brian has written in saying, isn't a large part of this that most people are poor or struggling? Cheap food wins. Richer people with disposable income care about fine restaurants. This is one of the things that you write about in the book, that it's very easy for big food to say, well, we have to do it this way because we have to be able to mass produce all these foods cheaply. Talk about that.
It breaks my heart for people to think this is a movement of the rich. And there are many beer brewers, chocolate makers, coffee roasters that feel the same way I do. This belongs to everybody. The democratization of taste is so critically important. And when we'll just say big food to kind of use as a catch-all, says this is all people can afford, what I want to know is, why is this all we can afford? Why are people being paid wages that are so low that we can no longer afford to feed ourselves well?
Well, you also point out that many of the people who grow some of the foods that we love the most, like coffee, like chocolate, can't afford to eat the product. You write about the farmers who grow the chocolate who had never tasted a chocolate bar.
Exactly.
Until you let them taste a chocolate bar.
Well, I didn't, I don't want to come
or
in as some hero.
Did.
No, I was with chocolate makers from Cho Chocolate, and they were sharing their chocolate. But I want to just say, really, it's so important to remember that the United States, we pay less as a portion of our income for food now than we did during the Great Depression.
Wow.
And we are the country in the world, the developed country, that pays the least a portion of our money for food. So I want to be very clear that when people say this is, that's for those people over there, the people who have a lot of expendable income, or that's not for me, I don't have those fancy tastes. I wrote a book to emphasize to everyone, this belongs to all of us. There are flavor guides in every chapter, so you can actually understand and tease out what this diversity means. Trust me, when I started, a coffee was a coffee. Bartles and James wine coolers is where I started this journey. This belongs to all of us. We all have taste, and we all have the opportunity to participate in the transformation of our food system.
And it's very learnable, which is the hopeful sign. It's not like you have to be born into this delicate, sensitive path. Palate. It's all, you can be trained to recognize unique flavors and to start and to actually transition your own taste buds to resisting certain flavors to actually starting to love them as you expose yourself to more and more of them.
That's what researchers have found. It's really, that's the ticket. Knowing more about them and exposing yourself to more of them is the ticket to overcoming fears of new flavors.
But I do have to ask about cost, because we've talked about heirloom tomatoes. And I used to eat tomatoes like apples because they were just delicious by themselves. And now it's like eating a piece of paper. They're not good, although heirloom tomatoes are. But they are more expensive.
So what I would say is they should be. Farmers grew those foods. They came out of the ground.
But then you're making the argument that Marian just made, that it's too, it's just for rich people.
So there's a big continuum between a tomato that costs, well, let's just, I exclusively buy tomatoes when they're in season. So an heirloom tomato does cost more. But what it is reflecting is the fact that it was grown by someone locally and that person is now being paid an affordable wage. So what I would ask is, at what cost is this cheap food? People now, globally speaking, people are dying of diseases that are related to overweight and obesity rather than being underweight. So it's a global community of what Raj Patel, an author, refers to as people who are stuffed and starved. So many diet-related issues. 40% of our food here in the United States is being thrown away, while 1 in 5 people is going hungry every night, right here in the United States. These are the issues that we're grappling with: food waste and hunger. People not being paid enough, and people, you know, exorbitant increase of wealth. The disparity between the rich and poor has grown. These are chasms that we need to cross. These are bridges that we need to build. But I think by dismissing most of the population by saying this is an effete movement that only belongs to rich, fancy people is really undermining what food means to all of us.
And there is – it's true that it's the people who are – who have the money who can afford to – the entry point on a lot of these things. But look at how much certain areas have grown as a result of a few people getting into it. For instance, farmers markets, which hardly existed in this area 10 and 15 years ago, are now existing in almost every community, every sub-community within the Charlotte area. There's 20 or 30 farmers markets that many people who can afford to shop at. Can everybody go to shop at? No. There are still food deserts. There are still a lot of people who can't afford to support the farmers directly, but many more can. So I think that we have to see it as sort of an evolving movement that takes time.
And at the same time that the choices in the grocery store, you say, have been limited, they've also been broadened. I don't recall when I was in high school being able to go to the grocery store and buy a mango. You can buy a mango today in the grocery. I don't recall being able to go to the grocery – of course, I didn't look. But you can go to the frozen food section now, and you can buy prepackaged chicken tikka masala.
Right.
Which you could not have – now, it's not as good as your mother's, I'm sure.
Mom's definitely
but
not
nonetheless, good. It's there. So we are – and it's happening around the world.
Those same researchers discovered on a local level, we now do see more diversity. But the global trend is towards sameness. And what – Peter just mentioned about farmers markets. Farmers markets are now increasingly accepting food stamps and increasingly accepting WIC, you know, SNAP and WIC supplements. So people who are of limited means can also avail of farmers markets and of this produce. But I want to again emphasize, this isn't just about the heirloom tomato and the Kraft chocolate.
Okay.
This is about the pivot in the grocery store toward the olive oil. That this – there is a continuum here of opportunity. But to say that most people can't participate in it, I think, is incorrect. Most of us actually can.
Of course, 60 Minutes did a story on Sunday night about 70% of the olive oil that you buy in the grocery store is not really olive oil. It's adulterated olive oil, and it's being adulterated by the mafia in southern Italy. So that they can make a great profit on fake olive oil. So how do you know what you're getting is real?
Well, we don't, I would say. In many instances, we don't. How do we know that any of the quality of foods we're getting we have to trust? And that's part of the reason I would rather go to a farmer's market and look a farmer in the eye.
Yeah, but you can't get olive oil at the farmer's
market. You can't get olive oil at the farmer's market. But what I'm suggesting here is that this isn't just about the fancy chocolate. This isn't just about the heirloom tomato. There is a range of opportunity to participate in preserving agricultural biodiversity. That what I don't want to have happen is people say, well, it was just about the fancy foods you talked about. No, it's about the beer that you get down the street at your favorite microbrewery. Uh-huh. All of this is part and parcel of saving agricultural biodiversity.
Because you point out that we have domesticated more than 30 birds and mammals for food, but only 14 of those animals provide 90% of the food that we get from livestock, and that the loss is staggering. These are your words. What do you mean by loss?
Well, the loss of opportunity, the loss of diversity in flavors, the loss of varying nutritional values. I mean, if we think about our Thanksgiving wasn't so long ago, our Thanksgiving turkey, you were talking about adulteration. Many of those turkeys are now pumped full of saltwater to puff up and make, you know, those turkeys more palatable. We're seeing, you know.
It saves you from having to brine them.
It saves you from, yeah, right. But the point is when we – what I would like to see happen and what the book is really about, I reference a poem that Derek Wolcott wrote in the very beginning of the book. The poem's called Love After Love. And the final line is, feast on your life. What I'm suggesting we do is start paying more attention. I am the woman who was talking about food, who was shoveling food into my mouth as I was reading, you know, news stories on the internet. I lost that sacred connection with food. And what I am suggesting is that connection means something. The connection to the people who actually grew our food. The connection to the land that provides this food. And in reconnecting, in simply paying attention, having consideration for these tastes, having gratitude for the places and the people that brought us these foods, we can actually start to change what the system looks like.
You've mentioned the word terroir.
Yes.
The French word, and it refers mostly to wine, but it can refer to coffee. It can refer to other plants that foods that we grow, and that you can actually taste the character of the region in which the food was grown. Why is that important?
You can. Well, I think it's important because I want to, because it's, again, what was undiscovered. The first time I tasted a coffee from Ethiopia, there was a little bit of milk in it. And I thought, is the milk sour? Because I've never tasted these notes in a coffee before. They were incredible. All of a sudden, I'm discovering in a cup of coffee, honeysuckle, jasmine, lemon, cherries, cocoa flavor notes. I mean, these things were simply not something I'd ever paid attention to. And I will tell you, my morning coffee is richer. My morning experience is richer for having discovered these things.
Yeah, you talk a lot about this idea of connecting, and all the way back from the first flavor in your mouth all the way to the farmer and even to the soil, to the microbes in the soil. It seems like ultimately, it's really about consciousness, isn't it? This book's about as much about consciousness as it is about food.
I say this is a story about food, but it's really a story about love. And it's about the care we have for each other. And it's about the long story and identity of who we are. And that's what food is. Food is culture.
And you also say that you introduced the idea of this terroir for several reasons. A, flavor, which you just talked about, but also as a way to introduce the importance of the soil to the foods we eat and the fact that we are wearing out the soil by growing the same stuff over and over again.
Stuff by not letting the soil rest, by not actually, you know, I mean, this is even in the Bible, for goodness sakes, that we allow the soil, the land to rest, that we keep one area fallow and then we cultivate it again. We are supposed to have a day of rest, that everything is moving at such a breakneck speed. What we are demanding of ourselves, what we are demanding of agriculture, we call these varieties in plants high-yielding varieties. Mm-hmm. And these are the ones that keep going and going and going until they just conk out. And everything is not a non – everything needs a break. Everything needs a rest. Every one of us needs to take a break. And I think this is really symbolic of like the way we want to live our lives. And I want to live my life – I think it was Thoreau who said like sucking the marrow from the bone. I want to savor these moments that I have. I don't want to sleepwalk through my life. I don't want to, you know – Facebook and text through my entire life. I want to pay attention. I don't want my head down. I don't want my food shoveled in my mouth. I want a different experience. And all those experiences are right here for us. They're at the farmer's market. They're at the grocery store. They're at the lovely restaurants. You know, they're in everything if we simply open our eyes and look for them.
You know, one of the things I liked about the book so much is that there's a whole cast of characters in the book. You interview and meet a lot of people and introduce us to a lot of people that I might call heroes of biodiversity. Can you talk about some of the people that really inspired you, who helped awaken you to understanding a deeper way of appreciating food?
Absolutely. They came from such interesting places. And, you know, for example, I mean, I hardly remembered my science from school, from grade school. I think it was the last time I'd taken a science class, you know, high school, excuse me. We save yeast. Yeast is a microbe. Yeast is responsible for making beer and wine into alcohol, turning juice into alcohol, or turning what we call wort, which is the kind of that sweet barley malt and water into beer. Yeast is also responsible for the flavor profiles in chocolate. And I had no idea that a microorganism was the thing that was sustaining. Yeast is what makes the bread rise. You know, it's this extraordinary thing that I'd never, ever considered. And there are multiple collections in the world, but I went and visited the National Collection of Yeast Cultures in Norwich in the United Kingdom. Who knew? Who knew there was a collection? Who knew we saved yeast? Who knew that yeast that they had saved in their collection could resurrect a beer for one of the largest breweries in the world? It's called Truman's, and they're based in London. And to me, these stories were simply fascinating because they were the way to understand the world. They were a way to understand history. They were a way to understand science. They were a way to understand culture. So the scientists at the National Collection of Yeast Culture are some of my heroes, as are the farmers preserving biodiversity in Ethiopia. I traveled, close to 11 hours on a journey that probably here in the United States would have taken us two or three, not accounting for Charlotte traffic, I will say. But those roads were so bad. And I asked the farmers when I finally met them. They were collecting coffee from some of the wild areas, coffee that we call forest coffee. And they simply said to me, thank you for coming and sharing our story. And, you know, we'll see packages that have pretty pictures of farmers on them. Yeah. And they never have names. There is no one in my book who goes unnamed. There is no one in my book who I don't create this hierarchy of the doctor is the fancy person who has the PhD and the farmer knows nothing. Farmers know a tremendous amount as long as we let this knowledge shine. And that's part of what I want us to do is recognize the gifts that people bring to us.
We have 90 seconds left, so let me share some more stuff that's come in while we've been talking. Gary in Concord with a correction, having been to McDonald's all over the world, I can assure you that a Big Mac from McDonald's in Moscow will not be the same as in Prague or Paris or Barcelona. Local tastes do creep into the standard taste in various parts of the world. Elizabeth, does your guest know that there are only 6 breeds of dairy cows, so it's not that outrageous that most milk comes from the Holstein?
90% comes from one. So if we have 6, why is that diversity not there? The McDonald's I mentioned in the book, they do account for local tastes, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And cheesemakers know that. Cheesemakers make cheese from many different kinds of milks, not just the Holstein milk.
Can you taste the difference? And if you were to go down to the 6 varieties of dairy cows, could you taste the difference in the milk?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean,
and
you
why
know,
is it important? Is it just important for taste, or is it important because we don't want to – if something happens to the Holstein, we'll have no milk?
Well, that's, to me, the greater challenge. If something happens to the Holstein, we have wiped out 90% of our dairy supply here in the United States. Why would we do that when we have 6 breeds that we could rely upon? I mean, that's a perfect comment. You know, that really helps to point to the need for diversification.
Okay.
And if you love cheese, that's a great way to kind of explore that, the difference in flavor. Because cheeses are very specific to the kind of milk and the cows that bring that milk to them to make the world's great cheeses, great cheeses.
Peter Reinhardt is our Johnson & Wales chef on assignment, who's responsible for bringing to us and our table this morning Simran Sete, who is the author of Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love. Thank you for the hour, I think. I'm a little worried now.
There's hope.
Based on your life.
There's hope. Read Simran's book. There is hope.